Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, how do editors select poetry? Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, news about poetry around Canberra. I'm Peter Searles. Today on Poetry on the Radio, we explore how editors select which poets and poems they will publish, and what they do with those poets and poems along the way. Some experienced poetry editors spoke about their complex roles at a session of the September 2022 Poetry on the Move Festival in Canberra, organised by the University of Canberra's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research. Here is some of what they said about how they try to work. First, they spoke plainly about what they do and don't like, acknowledging the inevitably subjective nature of their work, even though that element of editing was often not acknowledged in the past. Here's Kathy Kidawai, who specialises in writing and editing in Japanese forms, such as the short, meditative tanka. She selected those for the journal Cattails and various anthologies. She said what she looks for primarily is
originality. Something no one else has written. I like poets who take risks. Those who don't get caught up in the latest U-Butte, let's try this, with no heart idea. I've never accepted poetry as the tanka editor for Cattails Journal or any anthology I edited just because it was the latest craze. I always favour poems that enlighten and gift the reader with something that takes them deeper into life or amuses with skillful humour that has us laughing out loud and stays true to the emotional truth underneath the poem. In other words, are more than just a collection of beautiful phrases. If it rhymes, it does so unobtrusively. Is a sonnet, a haiku, or a tanka, doesn't draw attention to its cleverness at the expense of the heartfelt intention. Many poets don't know how to end a poem. Structure of a poem is important, even those poets that go deliberately against it. In the hands of skillful poets who know the rules, they can break them.
Kathy Kidawai. Some editors have particular preferences in what they'll publish, and it might not be what Jen Webb calls prize-winning poetry, works that are polished, but not unexpected and interesting.
My first technique is to keep in mind what I think of as the prize-winning poem, which I've talked to a few of you about in pejorative terms. And I don't mean that prize-winning poems aren't good poems. They're brilliant poems, right? It's the right word in the right place, the right punctuation, the lineation is perfect. It's a lovely poem. It has gravitas. It has tonality, and for me, it's like my mother has a very beautiful cottage garden. It's absolutely exquisite, jammed with flowers, and I love it, and I would feel really tired and bored by it because I've seen these a lot. I never get tired of looking at a jumble, a desert, a burnt forest, even though it sounds terrible, because they're so unexpected and interesting. So I don't tend to publish prize-winning poems, even though they are really good poems. I'm looking for the poems that don't necessarily have gravitas. The poems I didn't spot at 12 paces because they were so obviously excellent poems. I'm looking for the ones that surprise me. And the reason I don't want to publish the prize-winning poems is that for me there's a sense of déjà lu, which is it's like déjà vu, but for reading, it's the already read. I know it. And I tend not to be surprised by prize-winning poems. I am surprised by poems that make me spend time with them, that make me think about what that imagery is, that aren't the posh frock that I wear on special occasions, that aren't that elegant boyfriend I dumped 25 years ago for the scruffy one I now have. They are objectively good. Those ones are objectively very, very good, but they don't shift the structures in ways that really interest me. And I say interest me because they interest other people. It's precisely what one of you was saying. There is an editor out there who will love that poetry, and I love it too, but I don't want to publish it.
Jen Webb. Shane Strange, editor of Recent Work Press, which has published many poets from around the ACT and beyond, joined a chorus of editors who said they respond well to being surprised.
I'm not big on form. The fact that you've written a book of sestinas does not give me the thrill that it might some. Language, the eloquence and surprise of it, is fundamental to poetry. I'm particularly drawn to surprising language, a surprising poetic voice. I respond to content as well. Is there something being said here? Even if that's a deliberate attempt to not say anything.
Shane Strange said it's important for editors both to collaborate and back their own judgment.
I'm not the best poetry editor in the country, most certainly, most definitely not in this room. But I do know what I like, and I do know what I like to drink. And I do have a certain set of skills. I may not be able to tell you why your villanelle or your pantoum is incorrect, or why your meter is out in the fourth couplet of your ghazal. This kind of thing you would think should be the bread and butter of any poetry editor worth their salt. I'm also a mildly shit proofreader. But I can tell you why a line isn't working, why a word jars, or why a poem should start about two stanzas in or finish earlier. I can also tell you about how your collection is ordered, that is, where the poems appear in a collection and why it's better to begin with one poem over another, to end with one poem over another, to swap sections around or dispense with sections, or to get rid of poems altogether. To a greater or lesser extent, this is much of the work that I do. Poets are often too close to their work, and providing that distance view to the poet for their consideration is, in my view, the bread and butter of poetry editing. Like most things of value, editing a manuscript is a productive collaboration between two people trying to make the best work possible from what's in front of them. It's a human relationship, and as such should be approached with respect and a degree of professionalism. But it is also fraught with those fuzzy things that make all human relationships difficult sometimes. Ideally, trust should be engendered on both sides. As an editor, I freely admit my fallibility while offering the poet an opportunity to collaborate on their work. I make suggestions for consideration, not edicts for obedience. I'm open to being wrong or not understanding or to missing the point. I explain my reasoning for consideration and further discussion. Some need firm guidance. Some no guidance at all. We meet at this bridge. Let us cross it together.
Bear in mind, Strange reiterated, that a key attribute of the poetry editor is to have informed taste.
As poetry editors, I think it's fair to say we've read a lot of poetry and we have... That taste is informed. It's an informed taste. It's not... And I think we're able to make those distinctions, I guess. Maybe they... You know, they're inflected by subjectivity because we all experience language in a different way.
Spare a thought for poetry editors because their job is hardly easy. So said some on the Poetry on the Move festival panel, detailing the challenges they encounter. Here's Paul Munden, an adjunct professor of writing at the University of Canberra, much published poet and screenwriter and experienced editor.
I just want to start by taking a step back and thinking about what we mean by this term editing in the broadest sense. I mean, sometimes it's used as a kind of terribly kind of vague thing, someone's editor, and they just have kind of some kind of general overview of what's going on. At other times, it's a really hands-on process involving a whole range of things, including commissioning, selecting, and I'm sure we'll discuss the difference between those two and the very different difficulties presented by those two things. And then what I'm going to call fine-tuning, to distinguish it. You know, that's the heart of the matter, but I'm using that term to distinguish it from this overall sense of what an editor does. Because there's then also sequencing, typesetting, proofreading, and underpinning all of this, communicating. And that's a two-way process, and it's absolutely crucial. And it can go wrong. I saw a post by the wonderful editor of Cordite, Kent McCarter, the other day on Facebook, and he said, "Wow, gotta love waking to 24 complaints on things authors forgot themselves in their own work." And yes, I suspect anyone that has been involved with editing knows that experience. It's unavoidable, you know, however much care you take. Someone, you know, communicates saying, "That's a very out-of-date bio you've used." And I think, yes, that's the one you provided. Or, you know, there are no italics in the last line of my poem. Indeed, that's how it came to me. So it's a matter of being polite apart from anything else, because if you have to deal with that kind of attitude, you're going to think, I didn't think I want to deal with that poet again, necessarily. So sometimes that whole range of skills, you know, if it's a major publishing house, you know, each thing is dealt with by a different person. But more often than not in the poetry world, we're talking about very small operations, a one-man band doing everything. And how do we learn that? In at the deep end, usually. In my case, I was at York University as an undergraduate with Oliver Commins, who is at the back here. And we were writing poetry, and we decided we wanted to share our poetry and share the work of our friends. So we just kind of set to and did it all. In the wider world, it's slightly different. Suddenly, you know, you're submitting to Craig Raine at Faber or whoever it is. But in a sense, they may not be friends, but they are still peers. Because in the poetry world, it typically is the case that the poetry editor, even at a major publishing house such as Faber, is a poet themselves. And there's a major difference there between the poetry world and the world of novels, because it is much rarer for that to be the case with, you know, the editor of a fiction list is rarely a high-profile novelist themselves.
Paul Munden, a former director of the Poetry on the Move Festival. He said he's grateful for painstaking inspection of his work, so tries to provide that for others. Often poets know their first editors because they are poet friends.
Those friends are often critical friends, editors by any other name. I mean, I rely on them hugely to give me feedback on my work and do a degree of fine-tuning for the things that I'm just blind to, and that's immensely useful. You know, that can be word choice. They might question a particular word for its clarity or its interest or its tonality, you know, in terms of where it's placed within the rest of the poem. Punctuation, rhythm, structure, coherence, consistency, all these things. I'm very, very happy if someone pulls me up on any of those matters. And at book level, sequencing in particular is something that people can give really useful help with. And the fussier, the better. I mean, I remember when I was first published in a Faber anthology, and someone came back saying, you've used the phrase second hand, but is this supposed to have a hyphen? And I'm thinking, you know, God, how pedantic can you get? But I was, you know, in retrospect, I was really pleased that they did that, because now there it is in print correctly. They wanted to know whether it was second hand, as in previously used, or the second hand of a clock. And it was actually slightly ambiguous in the way I'd used it within the poem. So I think it's a matter of do as you would be done by. That's the phrase I would use. You know, treat poets, if you're an editor, with the same respect that you know what I mean, vice versa. I was poetry editor for Westerly for a while, and the thing I liked about that was, you know, in some situations you're dealing with straight rejection or acceptance, you know, it's black and white. With Westerly, I was given the opportunity to go back to authors, even though it wasn't me directly in communication with them, and question things, just as my critical friends might question my work. And I think that's a way of helping writers become better editors of their own work. And I remember a Writers in Schools project that I was involved with, where young people were working with published authors, and they were asked at the end, what did they like best about the project? And they said, getting rid of all the rubbish, which I think was wonderful, because that, in a sense, is another word for editing. And, you know, even, you know, high-profile published authors very often do not get rid of enough rubbish, and they're not open enough to editors suggesting that they do get rid of considerable quantities of rubbish in some cases. When we teach writing, you know, we teach redrafting, which in the US is known as editing. So, you know, if you are a poet, you are an editor, editing your own work and, in more cases than not, helping others edit their work too.
A repeated refrain of the editor's session was that when selecting poems for publication, editors cannot be objective. They always have their views, and in that sense are inevitably gatekeepers. Ideally aware that in the past, gatekeepers excluded many individual poets and whole categories of writers. Here's poet and editor Sandra Renew, co-founder and co-editor of Not Very Quiet, a twice-yearly online journal of woman poets, published from 2017 to 2021.
When you are trying to select poetry from, I'm assuming most journals have at least 100 poems to read, to pick maybe 30, or they have 4,000 poems to read, to pick maybe 100. Those decisions are really difficult, and they're right from the get-go. They're about gatekeeping and they're about politics. And the editor needs to understand that however goodwill they are about not being the traditional gatekeepers, as soon as they're selecting editors, they're gatekeeping.
Sandra Renew. She recommended a procedure she and her fellow editors adopted for Not Very Quiet to guard against, but also to accommodate the reality that editors are necessarily subjective.
All the editors would read all the poems and pick their best, say, 30, and we'd look at the list and work out all the ones that had been picked by at least two of the editors, maybe all three, I don't know. Sometimes it changed. And then we'd look at the spaces that we had left and divide them up among the editors. So then each editor got free go to pick so many poems. And they didn't have to justify that, argue that, try to bring everyone else to their point of view. Every editor got a free choice of half a dozen, sometimes more, poems to put in the journal. So in terms of the selection, our objectivity was that we understood that we weren't objective, that all of our editors would have something different to bring and would read every poem in a different way. That pretty much worked, I think.
Indeed, there's no point in claiming objectivity, said Shane Strange.
There may be a tendency to see poetry editors as objective entities who will somehow refine your work to an ideal standard of goodness. But the truth is that editors are as laden with questions of taste as we all are. We're often prone to grumpiness and bad days, to misreading or misunderstanding. We are fallible and often uncertain. Or we should be.
If editors are fallible, that would seem to imply that sometimes they simply won't get a poem. That can be the poet's fault, of course. How does an editor figure out whether it is? Here's Jen Webb again.
I think our tastes obviously inform what we go for. But if you're open to, if you're alive to the world a little bit, and I think you have to be as an editor or a curator, then you will see stuff that is not your taste and not your literacy, but it's got a something there that you must respond to.
Paul Munden echoed this view.
And yes, I like poems, you know, to use Peter Porter's phrase, with their laces done up, but I'm also equally interested in that poem that has one of the shoes left undone, you know, with purpose. And I also think that to some extent we work really hard to compensate for our own bias. When I was reading for Westerly, I found I was faced with a lot of prose poems, and I found I was resisting them. I came to another prose poem on the page, you know, another dense block of prose instead of something that let the light in, and my instinct was to kind of think, oh, how am I going to kind of cope with this? But I worked hard to compensate for that and probably ended up taking more prose poems than anything else as a result. So, you know, you...
Unsurprisingly, sometimes dealing with difficult poetry can test editors' forbearance. And then the problem is the poet's.
If the poem speaks to me, however difficult I find it, I will spend time with it and kind of make a decision based on the connection that it makes with me. But in terms of the detail that we were talking about in terms of editing, rather than just selecting and going back to that poet and questioning particular things, that becomes much, much more difficult if the particular rules that the poet has created for themselves are kind of less evident than they are in, you know, perhaps more traditional work. It wouldn't stop me, and I would go back to the things about inconsistency. So if there were really interesting things that a poet was doing in this experimental work, but then suddenly, you know, their own rules seem to fall apart, I would question that. It wouldn't necessarily be a reason for kind of turning against the poem, but I would want to kind of hear from the poet why they would argue for how it has been done.
Still, editors' time and patience may well be limited. Sandra Renew says she asks,
what is that poet trying to tell me in that poem? And if I puzzle over it for a short time and I can't get to it, then to me, that poem, for me, is not going to make it. That poem has to come to me as something meaningful that demonstrates that the poet kind of has some clue about what they're trying to do, and they're not just writing pretty words.
Of course, she adds, coming to terms with poetry is not like reading straightforward prose. It requires application, and that's what editors owe it.
The essence is so critical and so concentrated that the reader, that is you as the editor, needs to be able to come to that and read everything around it that's implied in the context that the poem was created in and is being read in. And that's a huge thing. That means that the writer needs to be aware that that's what you're asking the editor to do.
Again, says Paul Munden, it's a question of how much time an editor is able to devote to the tasks and how willing the poet is to collaborate to the betterment of the work and the gratification of the editor and author.
If you can question those individual words, etc., then I think you absolutely should. And as I say, I think that if you have time, then the more extensively you question, the better. And I think poets should respond to that personally.
Jen Webb agreed.
Alistair Patterson was editor of Poetry New Zealand. So I talked to him about his work as a poet and as an editor. And he said he would spend ages with poets. And he actually brought a number of poets along. He was actually teaching people to be poets, which is a really, really important thing to do. But he had time. I don't have time. I don't think any of us have time. And so he really was a remarkable crafter of people's understanding of poetic technique and what a poem can do in New Zealand. But you've got to have resources to be able to do that. And fortunately for New Zealand poets, he had those resources and brought a lot of people along. But I'd love to, but I don't.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, we've heard from a panel of poetry editors speaking at the September 2022 Poetry on the Move Festival in Canberra. They've included Kathy Kidaway, a poet and editor who specialises in tanka poetry, Shane Strange, a poet, publisher of Recent Work Press, and artistic director of Queensland Poetry, Paul Munden, poet, editor, and former director of the University of Canberra's On the Move Festival, Sandra Renew, a poet and poetry editor whose honours include winning the ACT Writers Notable Awards for Poetry in 2021 for her collection It's the Sugar, Sugar, from Recent Work Press, and Jen Webb, poet, editor of literary and scholarly journals, and Dean of Graduate Research and Distinguished Professor of Creative and Cultural Research at the University of Canberra. To Jen Webb go the last words, at least some of them.
Creative work is plucking nothing out of the air and trying to make it into something. And so editors have to, I think editors should be recognizing that this is somebody's blood that you're seeing, not their brain so much, but the beingness of the person and their sense of the relationship to the world and to others around them. And so, if, of course, things have to be rejected. But how one rejects, as everyone has said, needs to be done delicately, carefully, thoughtfully. I think we have to attend to somebody who has some expertise and looks at from the outside without, it's not their heart, their blood that's in the work. They're bringing the objective sense of how might this operate now in the world, the thing that you've pulled together. So I think that's a quite an important thing for editors to do. I also think that editors, like writers themselves, according to Graham Greene, must have a sliver of ice in their heart. Submissions are limitless. Time, editor's time, and page space or internet space are limited. And I say this mostly because the rejection of genuinely flat or poorly crafted work is easy. It's what you do. You've got 1,000 poems to look at. You can easily find 100 beautiful poems, fabulous, interesting poems in there, but you haven't got room for them. So then how do you get down to the 30 that you can publish? I know that online journals and books could absorb a lot more space than printed copies, but I have the sense that if there's too much stuff in there, readers can't see it.
For poets who've been rejected, and which haven't, she offered this consolation. Editors bleed too.
As an editor, have to be prepared to live with what you know will be the judgment of other poets and editors for the work that you've chosen. You know, well, that doesn't fit the mold very well. You must have pretty poor taste. And I've decided that I'm willing to live with that because that's the work I want to see circulate in the world alongside the prize-winning poems, alongside Keats.
The Rhyming Bugle. The Peter Porter Poetry Prize will be announced on January 19 from a short list of 5 poets and poems. The long list included On Seeing the Statue of Darius from Susa by Peter Ram of Robertson, New South Wales, and The Paddy Melon Wars by Canberra-based Penelope Leyland. Also on January 19 at 7 p.m, poetry readings will continue at Manning Clark House in Forest. At the event that evening, invited readers will present one signature poem or a poem by another poet which has particularly moved them. The series director, Hazel Hall, is stepping down from organising monthly poetry readings at Manning Clark House. Her successor in the role will be Kimberly K. Williams from February, when readings will resume on the fourth Thursday of each month. Here's advance notice that Sandra Renew and P.S. Cottier will launch their new book, V8, from Ginninderra Press on Monday, February 13 at Smith's Alternative. Renew's honours include winning the ACT Writers Notable Awards for Poetry 2021 for her collection Is the Sugar Sugar from Recent Work Press. She also took the 2020 ACT Writing and Publishing Award for Poetry and was shortlisted for the 2020 ACT Book of the Year for her collection Acting Like a Girl. Published in 2019 by Recent Work Press, that book reflects on gender, sexuality and coming out in the far north Queensland of the 70s and 80s. Piers Cottier's book of poetry, Utterly, was shortlisted for the ACT Book of the Year in 2021. In their new book, the two poets reflect on motor vehicles, transportation and roads travelled. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Artsound FM. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Special thanks to Annika Grant. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Music on today's program is from After the Demon's Leaving, a 1994 album by Bernard Santa Cruz, Frank Lowe and Dennis Charles. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.